Avi, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Jake. And I'm glad, we've interacted on Nostra over the last almost year, I would say.
But year or so, yeah.
It is our first face-to-face conversation, so happy to do this.
It's cool. And I always find it funny when I see someone's voice that I've listened to a lot, but their face with it. It's like, that's where it comes from. Okay, Avi, so today, I mean, to be honest, like following your journey the last year or so, there's just so many things that I find inspiring. And I'm like, what made you do all these things? And I'm in some ways a bit stuck where to start. But I think the latest move that you've made to decide to go on your own, let's kick it off there. Yeah. And you've got like 10 projects that you're interested in working on at the same time. So how you figure that out, I'd love to learn. But recently I saw a post saying, okay, I've tinned the job and I'm going to go for it. Why are you doing that?
Yeah, so I ran an AI product team at a large health tech company in the US. Mm-hmm. Very well-paying job. I've been at this job for almost 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's when I became I'd been in the broader crypto world longer than that, but I became a full-blown maxi late 2019, and shortly after that got this job. So I've always had this existential sort of angst, you could say, that Bitcoiners have working in fiat, which is, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. All my labor.
Quite a simple question.
It is a simple question. All my labor is going into ultimately increasing the stock price of this behemoth corporation. Yes, there's, you know, they build products that supposedly do X, Y, Z, but at the end of the day, it's all about shareholder value. So how am I making the world a better place now that I have this sense of meaning and purpose as a Bitcoiner? So that was that general existential dread I was carrying with me. I would say about a year and a half ago, the job became decidedly toxic and unmanageable. It was bearable until then. Also, you know, the nice paycheck helped ease some of the pain. And then pretty much for the last year and a half, since early 2024, I'd say, I'd been grappling with this. And the way I'd rationalized it to myself was, look, I have a 14-year-old son, you know, I live with him and my wife. He wants to be a football player. So my wife is sort of putting her career pretty much on hold to drive her around to soccer practice and all her scams and what have you, right? She still works a little bit, but it was on me to support the family for the most part. And the way I'd rationalize this is, look, I'm doing this for them. I'm, you know, working, stacking, although, I mean, what's stacking, right? It's all gone in a boating accident, but... In any event, I'm doing this to be a better father and a better husband. But what was happening over the course of the last year and a half was I was getting angrier and more frustrated at this incredibly toxic environment I was in. And I was running a large team, about 30-odd people, and they were they were reacting to the environment they were in. You know, there were people quitting, there were people... or people who just couldn't quit, right? Who felt trapped, and that was affecting their quality of work. And being a large company, you know, yes, I ran the team, but ultimately I wasn't an executive, so I didn't have executive decision making to make things better. So all in all, and then my life wasn't fun either. I was on 12 back-to-back phone calls a day, you know, working 10 to 12 hours a day. And then I'd finally sit down in the evening to work on some Bitcoin or Nostra related thing, maybe start writing a few pages of my SQL or plan my next project. And my wife would want to come and chat, or my son would say, Dad, you know, can you spot me in the basement on the bench press? And I'd snap at them. I'd snap at them and say, no, I finally have time to myself. The entire day I have these parasites at work who are stealing my time, stealing my attention on this nonsense, utter corporate nonsense, 12 hours of, or 10 hours of phone calls a day. And now I finally have time to do something constructive and creative, and you want me to do stuff with you or for you. So this was a pattern for a year and a half. And then a couple of, or maybe a month ago, I said, what am I doing? What this, I've convinced myself that I'm somehow going through this job so that I can be a better father and a better husband. Meanwhile, I've become a horrible father and a horrible husband. This is not the life I want to live. So that was one thing. That was one sort of
very difficult, probably, the self-reflection of that.
Well, you have to hit, at least in my case, I had to hit rock bottom. The other is there's this other element here, Jake, which is I always had a number in my mind, right? A moving number for the Bitcoin price. Oh, 500K. Then I'm set. No issues. And then that became, oh, maybe 300K is workable, or maybe 200K is workable. Mm-hmm. And so you know, one part was the realization that I'm doing this to be a better father and husband, but it's made me a worse father and worse husband. And the other was, what am I waiting for? I'm waiting for someone's permission to quit, when the only person who can give that permission is myself. Mm. I'm waiting for some magical number, waiting for Satoshi to show up and say, it's okay, I give you permission, you can do what you love. So that was it. So, you know, those two things together sort of coalesced about less than a month ago. And I said, I'm done. And, wow. You know, it was easy. Once I did it, it was like, why the hell was I waiting this long?
Yeah, I love it. It's funny how the goalposts change and you change them only for yourself, right? It's so stupid. It's it's a number on a piece of paper somewhere on an Excel spreadsheet. And it's like, well, hang on a sec, what's going on here? But the day that I quit my last fiat employment contract and did so, I was taking a risk, yes, but I don't think I'll ever feel that wealthy again. When it really sunk in, maybe a year or so later, and Bitcoin had rocketed by this stage, which helped, but it was like, I'm never doing that again. Oh my gosh. And it is an extraordinary sense of freedom. And you won't feel it till you try it. But where I'd like to take this, Avi, is shout out to Daniel Prince, because he came on my previous podcast, Bitcoin with Jake. Gosh, this would have been 2022 now, maybe. And he talked about the mindset he was in when he was working as a broker in Singapore. And I'd also had a similar experience as a broker in Singapore. And he'd read Tim Ferriss's book, Before Our Work Week, and there was a failure setting chapter. And instead of like, what are my goals? It's like, what are my fears? Why am I not doing this? And quite often you'd write these things down. It's like, well, actually, you're not going to be bankrupt if you quit this job, because you've probably got, you know, X many, you know, have much time of runway saved up, and you could then reduce costs, and you've got siblings that have a place you might be able to live, or a parent, and you suddenly realize that actually you're not going to be destitute under a bridge. So I wonder, was there anything within you that, from that decision-making process, like you mentioned those two things, was it also some fear kind of holding you back? And what were those things?
Yeah, decidedly. By the way, Jake, I just glanced at myself in the camera and I noticed I'm perspiring profusely. I have to say, so I live in upstate New York.
Sure.
Where there is no, and in the mountains, so there's no air conditioning here because, you know, we have about four days of warm weather. And it's about 37 Celsius right now.
Bloody hell.
And that's, of course, hilarious. I have to wear the hat because that would be off-brand if I didn't. Anyway, sorry for that digression.
It's 37 is hot. Whoa.
It is hot. It does not get this hot here.
I grew up in the UK, RV, and it's very rarely very hot there. But in a place where it's not equipped to be very hot, it's very uncomfortable.
Yes, for sure. So in case your audience is wondering why I'm sweating profusely, it's not because I'm I'm panicking.
I'm really putting you under pressure.
Yeah, exactly. You asked, was there fear? Yeah, there was a fear.
Yeah, what was scaring you or holding you back? Because I think that's something that we all really resonate with when you think through those.
Yeah, it was, you know, I had, you know, a small amount of savings. I'd put that off the table. I said, well, I can't touch that. That's for my son, or that's for some other point in the future. And so I wasn't counting that as money I had. So that was the fear. Well, if I stop, then where's the money? And then the realization was, well, that it's there. The money's right there. I mean, what am I saving that up for, if not for moments like this?
Mm. Cool. And so something I've written down here, Ravi, is inspire son. And it strikes me that a father who's willing to back their own skills and their own vision and go out and go for it, it's a much more inspiring role model than the one who feels imprisoned and comes home grumpy and doesn't want to spend time with you.
Right.
And the irony of that is crazy, right? Because you, as you said, you were thinking you were doing it for someone else. But really, right. If you do things for yourself, that resonates within the family unit far more positively and strongly. But it feels very contrarian, which is strange. I don't know why that is.
I think we've just been conditioned to by society to fall into these patterns, right? You're a man. You're supposed to deal with the suffering and take it like a man and, you know, take care of your family. But sometimes taking care of your family is being present. In fact, not sometimes, almost all times, being present there's nothing better than that, right? I mean, and here's the other thing, Jake, you know, there's, my son's 14, right? 18, most likely, he's gone. So that's, you know, gone from the house, doing his own thing. There's a, you know, 34 to 38 in a person's life, or 44 to 48, even 24 to 28, there's really not that much of a difference in a person in 4 years in those decades. 14 to 18 is massive. Huge. It's huge. So I think that factored in as well. I wanted to be present in these critical, you know, presumably last years of his childhood.
And that really brings to mind for myself, it's like the 12-hour workday that you were doing in exchange for supposedly money and supposedly security or supposedly a future for your wife and son, this pot of, you know, dollar signs you've got sitting somewhere, however you store it. It's really kind of, what's the right way of saying this? It's kind of stagnant, and the energy's not flowing with it, especially if you're upset about it. This idea of being present, it's like, well, that is far more important. So it's like, what's the actual cost of this pot of savings? And, you know, the hours you exchange over a 12-month period that equal this many dollars, it's like, well, how many hours is that? And is that wealth, or is that actually, you know, a lot of stress for not enough? And we don't really kind of take a step back and look at it like that sometimes.
Yeah, agreed. And I think it's a healthy way of reflecting on these things. And again, I think it goes back to societal conditioning. Most people take it for granted that the 9-to-5 rat race is all life. There is to life, right? And maybe it takes, for some people, it takes hitting rock bottom emotionally to be then able to reflect on that with more clarity.
Well, that I definitely agree with, Arvi, in terms of like our toughest times are springboards for cool stuff. We just don't really realize it when we're kind of like trudging through. And right. And so with that, Arvi, I'd love to understand. So the job you were doing, I believe you're a product manager. Would that be how you'd describe yourself? And
yeah,
like, I'd love to understand what your kind of skill set is. And obviously it's very varied in terms of the creative output I've already seen. You're running a podcast, you've written books, you want to build a startup business with technology at the core of it. There's so many things that, you know, we can all create, but like, what's the base case? Where are you coming at this stuff from, and what is it you love doing?
Yeah, so I mean, professionally, I started off as an engineer, electrical engineer, worked in research for a while, moved on to financial engineering, then got into securitization. Was essentially a technical product architect, technical product manager, if you will, and then went on to run teams of product managers. At my latest job, I was working on an AI team, and I had about 30 people in my direct and indirect line of reporting. So that's, in a nutshell, that's sort of my professional trajectory, just technical product stuff with originally an engineering background.
Cool. And so when I make friends in the kind of Bitcoin ecosystem, with people that have different skill sets to me, it helps hugely to increase my due diligence in this thing. Because all of us are still like, someone please tell me what's wrong with this thing. Like, why is it going to break? Someone somewhere must give me a good reason why this thing's going to go to hell. And obviously, the more you look, the harder finding that thing becomes, and your conviction increases. And in some ways, Bitcoin's now this amazing tool upon which people like both of us can go out and just create new stuff. Right. You're like, I'm pretty confident this purchasing power is going to carry on. So if my costs are this, I get all this time. And the advantage then is that, well, actually, the value you can create with that time is probably far higher than what you think. Because normally it's like 20 minutes here and there with the child asking for your attention after a 10-hour day. So of course, your creative output's terrible. But give yourself like 4 hours in the morning after a good sleep and then an afternoon hanging out with your family. It's like, boom, this is a big change. And so I'd love to understand, how are you going to figure out what you're going to spend your time on as you've now got this big, like, more space to yourself?
Yeah. So maybe I'll list out some of the projects I wanted to, Jake. And it's going to sound like insanity to most people, that because, I mean, it's just, and it probably is insane if I try and tackle all of them.
I'm here for it.
So I have, and it's almost all entirely Bitcoin and Nostr related, and AI, right? Mm-hmm. It's all at the confluence of that. So maybe I'll start with the technical stuff. I started this company almost a year ago with Vitor Pamplona and John Gordon. Vitor is the creator of Amethyst, the Nostr client, and then John Gordon has a long healthcare background. He's on Nostr, long-time Bitcoiner, started Satoshi Health Advisors. And so all three of us have a long U.S. healthcare background. So we were talking some last summer, and we said, look, there is a massive opportunity here. There's so many issues with the existing healthcare system from a data and technology standpoint, which is data portability is a big issue. Data interoperability is a big issue, that you have all of these walled gardens and siloed systems that are incentivized to gobble up the data, capture it, keep it away from the patients, not have any kind of meaningful price transparency. This is especially acute in the U.S. And Nostr's got to fix this, right? I mean, we're talking about a way for people to own their own identity, create events that then can interoperate across clients, as long as, you know, the clients accept those event kinds. So we put our heads down and we said, yes, there is a massive opportunity here, but it needs to be bootstrapped, right? You can build one healthcare app on Nostr. By itself, it's not going to do a lot. Nothing too different from a centralized legacy platform app. However, the real power in this is if there are multiple applications tackling different use cases in healthcare, in health data. Like, one could be patients having sovereignty over their own health data, right? Maybe they run a relay on their own phone where they store all of their health information, which doesn't exist today, by the way, right? You have these large companies in the US that have custody over that data, and then the patient needs to ask for permission. That's one, right? A patient's personal health record on their phone, which they can then selectively disclose to doctors. Then another one could be a care discovery marketplace, where a patient can search for care and find the care they need. And there's full transparency on the prices. There's a web of trust-based rating for the doctors that they're seeking care from. And so on and so forth. You can have many such, right? Message boards, out-of-band care. So all of these together with Nostr as that substrate that allows them to easily share the data across each other. The same patient identity can be used across all of them. So that would be a game changer, especially in U.S. healthcare, but I think internationally as well. But for this, we need an ecosystem to be bootstrapped. So that's what we've been focused on. We had a challenge that ran from January to till the end of May of this year, where we had about five or six teams participate, building out different use cases, and we created a little bounty for them to do that. So that's Nos Fabrica. We're still in the process of bootstrapping it. I think now we're thinking with AI where it is today, right? We're going to bring in a lot more AI capabilities, build out an agentic framework that can spin up these use cases much faster. So that's what we're thinking. So that's the technical thing that I'm primarily focused on. And also some other, you know, playing around with some vibe coding and building out some apps. On the creative side, there are several, right? I think you read my book 24.
I did. Yeah.
So I'm working on, and as if you read it, you know that there needs to be a sequel, the way it ended. So I'm working on the sequel, about 25% through that. It's been stop and start until now because of the job. So there's that. I just released the script for a play called Waiting for Satoshi. I echoed that a little earlier. It's, if you're familiar with Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, right, which is these two guys talking on stage, grumpy old man saying, oh, we're waiting for Godot, we're waiting for, and of course, Godot never shows up. And it's a funny play, but it's very nihilistic because Godot never shows up. So Waiting for Satoshi is inspired by that, but it's not nihilistic. So you can imagine what happens at the end of the play when these two middle-aged men sort of waiting for Satoshi to come and solve all of their problems. What happens there? So there's that play. I released the script open source. It's on GitHub. Anyone can take it and run with it, change it, and so on. Okay, that's one. What else? This is a big one that I'm... This is actually the favorite one of... It was hard to pick favorites, but I'm really excited about this one. I released a pilot episode for an Anthony Bourdain inspired food, travel, and culture show, but with Bitcoiners. It's called Finding Home. The pilot premiered at the Warsaw Film Fest. I was at BTC Prague last week. I filmed the second episode, and now I'm talking to more folks to film future episodes in different locations. This one really, I love food, I love travel, I love culture, and of course, talking to Bitcoiners. And what's better than that? So, right, I've made the first two episodes by pulling a lot of favors and doing a little bit of self-funding. Mm-hmm. Once I have the, you know, two, maybe three episodes out, I think it'll be enough of a base to try and get a studio to pick that up. So that's three creative projects. And, you know, then, I have Plepchain Radio, my podcast. I have another AI podcast, which relatively new. It's called The Acceleration. And then a third podcast, which is more like a, it's not a podcast, it's more of a performance art using AI. It's called Rendezvous with Claude and Friends. Cool. So, yeah, I think I might have missed a few, but these are some of the things that
plus,
I've been
of
focused.
Course, plus, of course, being a parent and being a husband and
yes.
You know, whatever else you've got going on. Arby, yes. I love it. It's awesome. We are, at our core, creative beings. And I think one thing that we struggle with is this idea of like, okay, you've got to get educated in a specific niche. And when you get into that niche, that's the best way to maximize value by the division of labor. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Get really, really, really good at one thing and you'll probably be better than everyone else. And therefore you get paid more. But actually, if you're not going to be an employee, that model kind of breaks slightly. It's like, well, actually, what if you can own equity in lots of different things and you are a driving factor in lots of different things? And something I've been working on with a shout out to one of my mentors, Jason Parks. He's an energetics expert, Jason. And he's like, what this comes down to is how big your vision actually is and creating what he describes as a self-image. And this is someone who spent time with the Shaolin monks in China and is a very, very advanced martial artist. And if you say, I, Arvi, am going to do all these things, a lot of people say you're completely insane. But in Jason's mind, what you're able to do is create your own reality. Mm-hmm. And so if you're able to actually sit down and say, these are all things that I'm passionate about, these are all things that I'm capable of doing, I'm going to go and do it, that self-image at the start enables you. Whereas right. If you don't even have that, then of course you don't create any of them. And it's something I'm slowly playing around with, which would include a proper 10-year vision. Mm-hmm. So 2025 energetically is a year of change. And it's like the year of the snake and people are shedding skins and there's all sorts of stuff going on. But it's a great time to also, okay, where are we going to set sail? And it's just awesome to hear you talk about all those things, because why the hell not? Like, honestly, like, why not? You've got all this time in the day that you now control. And really, it's about compounding. It's about chipping away at each one and choosing the right people to work with. Where I'd love to start, Avi, basically, a lot of that resonates. It's awesome. Oh, please, please.
So just one quick thing on that. I'm certainly going to put the saying to test and see if it works, which is you can just do things. We'll see what happens.
Yes, cool. Okay. Yeah, but I feel like that's a much more intuitive sense of being. Just do it.
Yeah.
Because it's the analysis paralysis where you're stuck in your head and you don't try anything and then you don't learn. Finding out what you don't want to do is just as important as what you do.
Right.
And so, Avi, let's start with Nos Fabrica, because I saw a pitch deck and I mentioned to you that I was slowly starting to look at doing some early stage equity investing again, having not done any for over 5 years. And I have had another opportunity come along, which is in Satlantis, the business Alex Svetsky is building. And they're doing a crowdfund at the moment. I'm just doing due diligence now and I'm very close to making an investment there. What blows my mind is this combination of AI, Bitcoin, and Nostr, and use cases that just didn't exist before, and entrepreneurs using tools that weren't around before, but could create huge value. And with Nos Fabrica, you mentioned bootstrapping. It's an interesting choice because in some ways, the more control you have, the better as the creators of that. But just a pain point of mine that resonates with that business is you turn up at a new practitioner. So my wife and I like going to acupuncture. We like going to chiropractic appointments. We like going to massage. We might even have, like Jason, energetic sessions with someone or more kind of astrology type stuff. There's all sorts of different tools you can kind of leverage from other people, but they all start in the same way, which is, what's your health record? And you're just like, oh, what you mean I've got to repeat the whole thing again? You know what I mean? It's like 37 years of life by this stage. And it's like, okay, and you've got all these tropes that you whip out, and it's like it's almost self-reinforcing the health journey you've been on, and doesn't necessarily recognize, you know, with like a nutritionist, for example, that wants to know about a test you did a year ago. It's like, which in my email somewhere, you know, I can't remember. Was it that company NutriPath that did it or someone else? So I love this idea of a user-centric digital experience in which the data is controlled by the user. Mm-hmm. Talk me through why Nostr enables that and any early traction that you've seen with a specific use case that might help give that some flavor.
Yeah, I mean, the simple reason for why Nostr enables that is the game changer for Nostr is that the user identity exists at the protocol level and not at the application level, right? And in the traditional tech world, if you go to a hospital and you get some tests done, it goes into their system. There's an application in the US there. It's Epic or Cerner or, you know, some of these big names, right? They create an account for the user. They own that identity. So as a user, yes, you can log in, but you're always asking for permission from someone because you don't control your identity for different pieces of data. The biggest thing, I think, for Nostr is it moved user identity from the application layer into the protocol layer. I mean, in theory, any user can derive their NPUB and NSEC with pen and paper. I mean, it would take a very long time, but the math is there, right? It's a simple mathematical relationship, the Schnorr signatures that connect the NPUB and the NSEC. Now, of course, it's easier to use a machine to spin up an NPUB and NSEC. Once you do, it's yours. As long as you don't lose your NSEC, you control that. So you then get to decide with that NPUB and NSEC, you can sign events, right? And you can choose which relays you broadcast those events to. It could be your own relay. You could, and now with Blossom, right, which is more geared towards storage of data files, you can choose which Blossom server you're sending your data blobs to. That's because you control your identity, you control what you sign. And so you apply that to a medical record, right? Yes, you have to solve the problem of going back into the past and getting everything into Nostr. But so let's just set that problem aside for a second. But if everything going forward, any medical data you have, it's an event that you sign, and you can choose which relay that gets relayed to, which Blossom server, if it's like, if you're talking about like images or what have you, it gets stored on, and then you can selectively disclose to whoever you want. If you go to specialist and they say, show me your medical record, you don't have to show them the entire thing. You say, what do you specifically want to see? Okay, well, you pick that out, and obviously you'll have an application, a Nostr client that's, you know, where you can easily search through, you know, different aspects of your medical record and share what you need to share with them. So it boils down to controlling identity and controlling the ability to sign events as an individual that makes Nostr a great fit for having your own health record. I actually don't see how you could do this outside of Nostr to have that level of sovereignty over your own data. Because, I mean, let's say I create a non-Nostr app that says, hey, here, there's an app on your iPhone and you can download the data wherever you want. Well, there's an application that controls your identity, so they can rug pull you at any time.
It's so cool. And the fundamental idea of protocol layer identity, that's really the thing to hammer home here. It's like, this is a new thing that didn't exist before that thankfully solves a very, very big problem. I guess to your point about the bootstrapping and running the bounty that you did, I'd love to know more details about how you did that. But it's really about attracting talent to Nostr to then deploy them in areas that you think might be interesting, but you don't know. So run us through how you guys kind of came to the conclusion that running a bounty was a good idea, and how did you attract some talent to have a crack at it?
Yeah, so, you know, look, we knew there were several apps that needed to be built, right, to show the true interoperability of Nostr. And I touched upon that a little earlier, right? We decided it didn't make sense for us to build every single one of those apps. And if this was a community effort, I think there'd be a lot more strength in that. So the way to, now we could have, of course, done a call to action and said, hey, here are some 5 or 6 interesting ideas. Go and knock yourselves out. And maybe one or two people would have picked it up, or maybe not. Maybe we've just, you know, gone into the void of the chronological feed of Nostr. So putting a bounty out was, you know, served a couple of purposes. One was it created real incentives for people to build something, right? Because there was a chance to win something. And the other was it skin in the game from our perspective, right? To show that we're actually serious about building this, about bootstrapping not just applications, but a developer community around these really cool use cases. So that was our thinking around that. And then we had our initial call. Initial 2 or 3 calls. We weren't prescriptive about it. We said, look, here are some ideas, but you guys pick whatever you want. It doesn't have to be from this list. You pick something that you want. And we saw some really cool apps come out of it. One, I think the one that won was Runster. Now, it wasn't a health data app. It was more of a fitness app. It's a running tracker. But people are using it all over Nostr now. Wow. So Runster was one, but there are many others. There's Legacy Locker was a really cool one that came out. It's sort of the patient medical record sort of thing. Tim Boomer built this thing called SafeBox, which uses eCash to issue credentials and a lot more. It's almost like an everything app that he built, honestly. Med Scholar, which is like a decentralized PubMed, is being developed. And, you know, I'm not going to do justice. I'll stop there. But there were a few other of these apps that came out, and they were all great, right? So I think we saw some really cool stuff come out, and you could see them developing. It was really cool to see that, right? Someone would come in and present the idea on the third. We were having weekly meetings, right, for that 5 or 6 month period. They propose an idea. We'd go back and forth. Next week they'd come back and say, hey, actually, I took your feedback and I built, you know, XYZ feature. Here's what it looks like. And then you see the progression over the course of the next few weeks. You'd actually, then a UI would come on you know one of the following weeks, and then there'd be some actual functionality, and then you show some sign in and some actual use cases. So it's really cool to see that progression. These calls, we had anywhere from 15 on the low end, 15 people to 30 people attending these calls on a weekly basis. Many of them every week would show up and do it.
Wow.
So I would say it was a resounding success, what Brilliant. We were able to do. Yeah.
And Arvi, this is the kind of thing that gets me really pumped up from an investment perspective. So one of the struggles I've had, and one of the reasons I haven't done any early stage investing for the last kind of 5 or so years, A, the Bitcoin bug itself. It's like, just own this stuff in self-custody. And what a ride it's been already. It's incredible. But owning Bitcoin businesses, like, what are you going to do? Own an exchange or own a wallet business? Like, how do these things actually make any money? I missed the first wave of equity investing in Bitcoin businesses of like 2017, 18, 19, where the likes of Unchained and stuff were first founded. But with Noster, it seems obvious to me now that this is a protocol that you can't own any of the protocol itself. Like, you can own part of the Bitcoin network, but you could own equity positions in companies that are building on top of Noster. Mm-hmm. And so actually what you've just described is kind of like an accelerator program, or it's kind of like what a VC fund might do when they've got a hunch on a couple of things. They say, okay, we're going to run a competition. It's good for their marketing and blah, blah, blah. In a way, the three of you guys as founders are like the fulcrum of that, and you're sifting through the ideas that come back from the marketplace with this bounty. And I love it. What an amazing way to get attention somewhere that will be interesting mm-hmm. to you guys. And you wonder if Nos Fabrica itself could almost be like an investment vehicle. You know what I mean? It's like, actually, you could put Bitcoin into Nos Fabrica and then use that position to fund things that you guys see that are interesting that are coming through. Right. That's an idea that springs to mind now. It's probably something you guys have thought about, I'm sure. But it's really just coming down to this idea of, like, how do you incentivize people? Mm-hmm. And yes, owning Bitcoin in self-custody is the best personal savings vehicle. But we've all got to take more risks than that, because how are we going to build anything for this thing to actually work? Right. And I love what you've just described. It's incredibly cool.
Yeah. And I'll make a slightly broader point on what you just said, which is outside of Nos Fabrica, which is, I think the easiest thing to do is, yeah, let me just hold Bitcoin, right? That's number go up technology, and I'm going to be fine. Why should I take that risk? If you go back to the Medicis, right? Mm. I mean, they could have just hoarded gold. I mean, they didn't need to commission these incredible artworks that they did. And if they'd looked at the 1 year rate of return on the Sistine Chapel, or the 10 year rate of return on the Sistine Chapel, or even the 20, 30 year rate of return, probably not a lot, but what is the 500 year rate of return on the Sistine Chapel? Absolutely priceless, right? And what did they insured with their patronage, I would say, it wasn't even an investment, right? It was the patronage, is the culture endured. So I think I'm not directing this at you necessarily, Jake, but the broader sentiment that, why should I invest when Bitcoin is going up? I'll just buy and sit on Bitcoin. Is, well, what kind of a world do you want to live in? What kind of a world do you want your children to live in? If you are a true Bitcoiner, I would hazard to say that you want a world in which freedom technology is thriving. There's less censorship. There's more privacy. There's, users have freedom and the ability to selectively disclose what they want to about themselves, and so on and so forth. So I think some of these investments, yes, there could be financial reward that perhaps even outpaces Bitcoin in the short term. But I think more than that, the other way of thinking about it is, like the Medicis, you're doing this so that the culture endures, not just over a 5 or 10 year period, but over centuries.
Wow. And that idea of 500 years, I mean, that immediately catches my attention. It's like, well, hang on, no one living the now normal fiat life can think about like 5 years. And it's more like 5 days or 5 months, maybe. But 500 years is not even on the radar of a very, very, very small percentage of the population. And I think to re-engineer ourselves around that concept is incredibly exciting, isn't it? Because it just shifts things so much. It's like if you're trying to plan for 500 years, like, well, your decision-making changes straight up. And as capital allocators, it changes. And as entrepreneurs, it changes. Gosh, cool.
It also brings in a level of nobility, I would say, even to that endeavor, because you're no longer thinking about yourself, right? 500 years, I mean, well, who knows where modern medicine is going to go with AI, but I doubt we're going to live for 500 years, at least not yet, right? So you're thinking about like 10 or 15 generations down.
A lot later. Well, Avi, as a fellow podcaster, I have, without any doubt, more value than I would ever have imagined from starting recording conversations and putting them online. There's not necessarily a business case from it from a kind of revenue standpoint over the last few years of doing it, but the investment in the network, in the skills that you gain from it and the opportunities that arise are worth it without any shadow of a doubt. So I'd just love to learn a bit about, you know, why did you start PlebChain Radio and what have been some of the highs and some of the lows?
Noster was about 2 months or 3 months into the post-Jack wave, or the Jackening, as some like to call it, from December 2022. I joined Noster the day after Jack tweeted about it, December 15th, I think it was, of that year. And, you know, I'd made a lot of new friends. There was a lot of shitposting. There was, you know, fun stuff. And got to know a lot of people, you know, through Noster. And had a good rapport with QW in our back and forth. And I'd reached out to him and I said, look, we don't know where this thing is heading, but it seems like it's an incredibly exciting time. So why don't we be the first and just start a Noster podcast? Now, as it turns out, we weren't actually the first. There was a short-lived, more technically oriented podcast called Nostrovia that started probably a month before we did. Anyway, that's how I saw it. And so we just we still have the document where I wrote up like where I think this is going to go. Like, look, we'll keep it lighthearted. We'll focus on Bitcoin and Noster. Mm-hmm. We'll interview people and the day we stop having fun, we stop doing this. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, haven't stopped having fun yet. So you asked about highs and lows. So we're talking about PlebChain Radio right now.
Yes.
The highs and lows, I don't know if there are any lows, Jake. Not yet, anyway. There have been times, maybe there's been a 2 or 3 week stretch every now and again. It happens every 6 months where it feels like I'm going through the motions, but then we bring on a guest and we have a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, So
that's the closest I've come to a low, I'd say. The highs were there too many to count. I mean, we've had some phenomenal guests, phenomenal conversations, just eye-opening stuff, inspiring stuff. I hate to start singling people out because then I'm sure I miss some really good ones.
You don't have to do that. What I love the way I've listened to a few, and it's fun. The format's great, and the meme of the day always pretty much cracks me up. And it's so true. It's like, doesn't have to be kind of super serious, very technical, or, you know, separate money from state. If we don't, we're all doomed, which can happen because there's no doubt there's some fucked up shit going on out there.
Yeah.
The reason I asked about the podcasting journey first is you're transferring into more of an in-person style documentary show with the Anthony Bourdain inspired stuff that you mentioned. So what's it been like switching from a kind of digital podcasting experience to doing more in-person things?
I love it. I love the in-person thing. You know, I mean, not to say one's better than the other. There is something to be said about the audio-only podcast where, you know, we strip out the video, strip out all other distractions, just focus on the signal that's the voice is speaking. And then, you know, we've thrown in mixed in humor and all that stuff into it. So it's a lot of fun, but the in-person Bourdain style is some of the most fun. This Prague shoot that we did, that I did with Grafton from Vexel. I don't know if you know him, but like awesome guy, Mississippi guy.
I've seen him on a YouTube. Yeah.
Fascinating story, which I'm going to tell in the show, but he's a Mississippi guy who moved to Prague about 15 years ago. Mm. And now works with Vexel, this privacy, basically peer-to-peer Bitcoin exchange. It's all about privacy. It's just so much fun, just sitting over a nice meal, and you're not talking about Bitcoin all the time, right? Maybe it's 10% of it. The rest of it is he's talking about his granddad, talking about art and architecture in Prague. We're talking about the food there. We're talking about the wine. Listen, mate, I could do this show forever, right? The Bourdain style show, yeah.
And in some ways, it's exactly the same kind of thing I would love to be doing. And I wish year one, get back in the flow of doing podcasts regularly. I got distracted by some startup businesses and whatever. Mm-hmm. Not going into that now, but I also said year two, I'll start working on a physical studio type vibe. And I really love the longer duration conversations as well, like the 3 to 4 hours of people in person talking. And in particularly men, I don't know why, it's just like real shit. Like, let's talk about it and don't avoid the difficult subjects. And somehow it's like 3 to 4 hours in, you just get these incredible insights because you've got all the context first as to like how that person ended up in that position. But maybe it would be also fun and, you know, obviously over a meal. I'm intrigued though, just simple things like, did you have your own cameras that you took with you? Have you got someone helping you edit that? And like, what are the actual practical steps of taking the decision to try and create something like that?
I worked with the director for the pilot episode that we shot in New York at this Somalian restaurant called Safari, where they accept Bitcoin. So really fascinating story of a Somali immigrant in New York. A fantastic director. Unfortunately, he is just too busy. He's in high demand, right? He has way too much stuff going on. So, and this sort of came about maybe 3 days before I left for Prague. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I said, well, I really wanted to do a Prague show. So let's see what happens. And then so I reached out to a few folks. I reached out to Grafton, actually. I said, hey, do you have someone? I said, yeah, I have someone. So there's this guy, Kyle Huber. He's an ostrich as well, Bitcoin and ostrich. And he's an up-and-coming filmmaker. He's shooting a documentary in Bulgaria. And I said, hey, Kyle, can you be my cameraman for this? He said, done.
Cool.
I have the time. We can work something out. I can shoot 8 to 10 hours for you. No problem through the week. So he's the videographer. And here's the other thing that's super exciting to me. My friends, Lahav and Noah Grumman. So Noah Grumman is the lead singer for Scardust. It's a progressive metal band. They're Bitcoiners. Lahav is the videographer and director for all of their videos. And they're kind of a big metal band, right? Not reasonably well known in the prog metal circles. So Lahav is going to direct it. And Noah's going to help edit it. So it's super exciting. I'm uploading the footage right now. I brought back the hard drive and it's like 1 terabyte. Oh, it takes
really
2 days to update. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. So the skill sets that you need then are you need someone obviously to take the video in the first place,
yes.
But then you need someone to edit it afterwards.
Yes.
And so the director's role, the director's there with you in the restaurant saying, do this, do that.
Director can be the filmmaker, the videographer as well, right? But the director is someone who's thinking about the story, saying, look, you know, shoot this and make sure that they're sitting here, they're sitting there. You know, he's already thinking about how it's going to be edited and how it's all going to be pieced together. Because here's the thing, Jake, right? With this, I saw this with the first episode and I'm experiencing it now with the second. You shoot 10 hours or whatever it is, 5 to 10 hours. You pick the best bits of that and compress it into a nice 30-minute, quick-moving bit, right? So the director's already thinking about how this is going to look in the edit, how they're going to cut it. And, you know, we stage a few shots, saying, you know, like when you're meeting, right? Obviously you've met, but you want to show that on the video, right? You say like, okay, you coming from here, you coming from there, and nice. Say, hey, nice to see you.
Yeah, again. Cool.
Yeah.
And so do, it's just that kind of thing. It's on the one hand, build it and they will come. On the other hand, do as much customer discovery and proof of product market fit as possible before you continue. Just like, you don't want to be hunting down a shit idea, essentially.
Right.
Was this, I mean, it's still so early. That's what's so cool about asking this. So to me, this feels a lot like you just want to go and create this thing and you're just going to figure out how that happens.
Yeah, that's it.
And okay, cool. And so there's not really a process of going, all right, my target audience member is X. I think they'll enjoy a 30-minute long documentary. No. Like none of that.
No. I would, my current thinking is, this is the show I would love to make and I'm going to go make it.
Yes. I love that. And when that's another thing that I'd written down, which is do what you love.
Yeah.
You know, that's at the start of this conversation. You're just sitting in this long, this job is just absolutely draining you. I just want to go and do what I love. Yeah. Well, and the fun thing about that as a decision-making process is it's like the individual heads off in a direction. They're setting sail somewhere. And it's almost like the power of the idea, the power of the inspiration, the energy that goes with that, the stronger it is from that primary idea driver, the easier it is to pull other people along. Right. And that's what then creates the snowball effect.
Right.
Now, one of the first things I'm going to try and figure out how to do, because your episode that's already been published, where do I find it? Because I said I would watch it, but I haven't ever seen it again.
No, it premiered at the Warsaw Film Fest. Mm. I haven't released it publicly yet because here's the thing, Jake. Once you put it out on YouTube forever, what I'd want to do is, the show's called Finding Home. And ironically, I want to find a home for the show itself. Like find a studio that can host it. And I want to do this right. And my goal is to make a really high quality production. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe one day it gets picked up by Netflix. Who knows, right? But if not, some kind of independent media studio.
Yep. Cool. Okay. And so would you be able to reveal, like, obviously it takes your time, but you're putting your own money into it as well. So if there's anyone out there that's like, oh, I want to make a documentary or I want to do any of this stuff, like, how much does it cost to get something out there?
Well, I've been pulling a lot of favors, Jake, right? I've built a little bit of goodwill over the last few years. So for the first two or three episodes, I've said, look, can we do this value for value? Here's my situation. And they're like, I described the project. And I said, I'd love to be involved. Yes, I could do this. And you pay me what you think it's worth, right? So, and brilliant. So it works something out that way. I think this is obviously not sustainable long term. I also don't want to do this to people, right? I want to be able to pay. Like, you know, for 10 hours of shooting, I want to pay the camera person $5,000 or whatever the number is, whatever the right number is. Mm-hmm. I want to pay the editor who's going to do...
Yeah, because you value their time, being
a
point.
I value their time.
Yes.
The editing working through 10 hours of footage to get it down to 30 minutes, that's probably 80, 90 hours, 100 hours of work, right? I don't want to say, hey, I'll zap you 21 sats. Here's value for value. I want to be able to compensate whatever it is, $10,000, whatever the right number is for that. So for that, obviously, you know, it's need to sell the idea to your studio and they need to believe that they can presumably sell enough advertising or whatever, however they do the calculation there and then get the people paid.
Awesome. But it's getting the ball rolling in the first place. It's the key. Yeah. So, I mean, you're there. You're already doing it.
Yeah.
And it strikes me as interesting that when you say you're pulling in a lot of favors and you've got some goodwill in your back pocket, I think that's podcasting, right? People have seen you out there talking, just doing things, and they resonate with that. And they're like, you know, I'd really love to work with that person. Or I'd love to meet them. Or I'd love to talk to them. Just much like this conversation right now. So it's that non-financial return.
Right.
That isn't obvious initially, that actually does equal dollars later down the line. But it's like, how are you going to, you know, you're not going to count that as a revenue for Plebtrain Radio, but it definitely filters through. Okay, Arvi, awesome. Well, look, an hour has flown by and I'm totally unsurprised that that's the case. I've got tons of other questions, but we'll have to leave those for another time. Where is the best place for people to reach out and get in touch if they have any questions or they have any ideas for you?
Yeah, so I think the best place would be to go to my website, It's Casa Nostra, CASANOSTRA.INK. So it has a catalog of all my projects. You can contact me there. You can also reach out to me on nostraprimal.net/AVI. And you can, DMs are open. You can message me, whatever it is. Yep.
Awesome. Thank you, Avi. It's one of those things that I'm starting to do more of, which is like, it dawned on me, it's like, how many podcast guests can I get that are actually predominantly on Nostra? And starting to use Nostra DMs. Like when I previously did podcasts, it's all Twitter. You can just DM anyone. If you're already friends with them and you're posting content, they might follow you. That makes it easier. It's like, what does that actually look like if you completely transfer it across to Nostra? And this is one of those conversations, right? I reached out on Nostra. So cheers to Nostra and what an exciting future. I'm pumped to see what you create, Avi. So good luck. Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Well, appreciate the conversation, Jake. Lots of fun. And yeah, love to chat more.
My pleasure. Thank you.